Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Rangers. It's me, Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. It's 2024. Let's do this. Here's the credits, of course. Mike Rickberg sang that song at the beginning, and he wrote that song, and he sang it with Sarah Cohen, his wife. And he will sing the Mexican Hat Dance at the end of the program. Also, Patrick Brady, still putting this together. Video, audio, all of it. He's amazing. So, and Vilmos doing JackieCationStore.com. Squarespace is doing the regular Jackie Cation page, and I'm thinking of moving the Dork Forest and DorkForest.com away from WordPress because it's driving me nuts. But those are the credits. But if you go to JackieCation.com, you can get Dork Forest merch. You can get my stand-up merch. You can get my stand-up CDs and DVDs, which you'd have to have devices for those. You can also see videos and find out any number of things. I have another podcast called The Jackie and Laurie Show, but The Dork Forest is the flagship. 18th year, we're doing it, you guys. You can go to my Bandcamp or my YouTube for extra content. Please donate, is what I'm saying. It's 2024, and I think we've been in this long enough. Why don't you guys, everybody send me $100? That's what I'd like you to do. You can PayPal me. There's links all over the pages. You can Venmo me at Jackie Cation. You can find me at a stand-up show and hand me a sweaty wad of 20s. Do something. But I love doing the show. I would love to make some money, is what I'd like to do. In other news, I'm sure there's more things that I should talk about, but I can't think of them. But let's listen to who's going to dork out about something, because that's my favorite part. Thanks for listening, you guys. You're all great. Let's get into the show. It's me, Jackie Cation. I'm in my garage. This week on the Dork Forest, another pioneer in the world of podcasting, the other half of Jordan Jesse Go. Jordan was on a couple of weeks ago. You might remember him. It was a delight. It was about Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat.
I was about to guess that.
That's exactly what it was about. And welcome, Jesse Thorne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jackie. How you doing, bud?
I'm good. You have MaximumFun.org. That you began and is now worker owned, you guys, co-op, very yep. exciting.
Co-op all the way.
Yep. And you have several podcasts, but you started way back in the day, like before Dork Forest, 2004.
I started podcasting essentially at the dawn of podcasting. Like there was no podcasting for iPods.
Right. Yet.
I started podcasting when you had to drag and drop your podcasts onto your Rio MP3 right. player or whatever.
Yeah. Right. I think I had a Tune. Was it a Tune? Is that
Nothing
what it was called?
But the best. I had several Zunes.
That's might have been a Zune. Whatever it
Zunes
was.
Were great.
The Dork Forest started in 2006. You started 2004 and it was Sound of Young America. And let me tell you something about the Sound of Young America. You reviewed the Dork Forest.
Did we really?
Yes, in 2006. And
I don't think I did personally,
no,
right? Colin, our former podcast reviewer, somebody reviewed it, right?
Right. And the review was scathing and yet supportive.
Oh.
I said it was fun. But it sounded like AM radio held up to a telephone.
Yeah.
He wasn't wrong. He was not incorrect. And those episodes could be now heard on Bandcamp, you guys, or at least the 17 of the 200 that I did before I went to pre-recorded. I culled the best of them and I tried to do something with the audio. Just know in your heart that Jesse Thorne, he was there. He was there before us all. And, or very early days, earlier than almost anyone. So it's at Jesse Thorne on Twitter. Is it at Jesse Thorne on Instagram too?
At Jesse Thorne, very famous. At Jesse Thorne, very famous.
Oh, very famous. Thank you very much. And
Jackie's noting that.
I am making a note. And then, so Bullseye is over at MaximumFun.org. The John Hodgman podcast is over there. Jordan, Jesse, go. Thank you for finding time to dork out.
I'm glad to do it. I was so glad that you asked me at a time when I was actually available. The reason is John Hodgman, Monday is usually my recording, as we're recording this, it's Monday. It's right. usually my recording day for Judge John Hodgman with John Hodgman, but John is actually in New Haven, Connecticut, because his daughter just graduated from university there. I shan't say what university.
That's it. New Haven. You guys,
it's the community college.
Yes.
An accredited university in the Northeast.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Congratulations to John Hodgman's daughter. The Jackie and Laurie show is over at Maximum Fun too. If you guys ever want to go over and listen to Laurie Kilmartin and I celebrate and bitch about stand-up comedy, it's good times.
One of my favorite things.
Thank you very much. So you're dorkdom though. Let's get into it. There's no time.
It's all baseball, baby.
It's all baseball. You're wearing a baseball t-shirt. You're wearing one of those. It's a Tigers. Is that Detroit? Is that
no?
Who that is?
That's the Osaka Hanshin Tigers. Japanese baseball team.
Japanese baseball team.
I got this when I was a kid. I got this when I was 13 years old, and it fits me for
Still
some reason.
Fits you. Interesting.
Yeah, this is Japanese double extra large.
Okay.
It was a gift from his family I stayed with, and I think they just went there panicked and picked the largest size because they figured, well, he's white.
Right, and he'll grow into it.
Yeah, and I did. I grew into it. I found it in my mom's basement a year or two ago, and I tried it on, and I was like, wow, this fits me.
That font kind of looks like the U.S. team, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, sure.
Okay.
But in Japan—
They're not your team, right? Yep.
No, they're not my team, no. My team is the San Francisco Giants. I'm a native San Franciscan, and my dad was an A's fan, so I will always have— A soft spot in my heart for the Oakland Athletics.
Okay.
Although the A's have done their best to harden that spot, the people who run that team.
Oh.
But yeah, the Giants have always been my team. I mean, they went to the World Series in 1989 when I was 8 years old.
Oh.
The World Series happened during the Loma Prieta earthquake that year in San Francisco.
That's right. People were at the stadium and there was an earthquake, right?
Yeah. My grandmother called us at home because she found out about the earthquake because she was watching the World Series, and the earthquake happened while the prep for the World Series was on TV.
Wait, did they still have the game?
No. They postponed the World Series for like 2 weeks.
Okay.
Or a week. I don't remember. I was eight.
Right. Well, yeah, you were eight, but... Here's what I know about earthquakes in Californians. They're like, all right, it's over. And then they continue with their lives. So I didn't know if that was true with the baseball as well.
Yeah, no, that was a horrible trauma. That earthquake was a horrible trauma for me as an eight-year-old. I mean, I definitely, I didn't want to leave the house for days afterwards. And
was it a big one?
Yeah, it was huge. Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it didn't damage our house other than things in our house.
Right. Things fall down.
But, you know, my childhood best friend was with us, was with me and my mom. We had just gone somewhere and gotten home. And his mom had to walk from downtown San Francisco to our house because the traffic wasn't moving. So she just parked her car in the street and walked to our house. There was no cell phones, obviously, as well.
Right,
so
right.
She just came straight to our house. It was like a 2-hour walk to get
wow.
to us. And
that's
and make
some
sure
parenting. Holy
it
smokes.
Was okay. Yeah, it was, yeah. It was really intense. It was intense, but yeah, I've lived in California all my life. So at this point, while I'm always aware that I could die in an earthquake at any moment, I figure there's not much I can do about it.
There isn't. It's weird because different, other kinds of natural disasters, like I'm from Wisconsin. So tornadoes are a
thing. Badger attacks.
Badger attacks. Yes. Just out of the blue. But tornadoes, you just go in the basement and you hide and then it's over.
Yeah. And somebody on TV tells you it's coming.
Right. There is warning. There's all kinds of things that can happen. And it's amazing because when I moved here, I was like, well, it could happen at any time. And everyone who grew up here was like, yeah, don't worry about it. It's either it's going to kill you or not kill you. Try not to be under something.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. So the first time I've only been in sort of one big one. We're going to be knocking mm-hmm. on wood on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like when you're in Lake Michigan and your feet can't touch the bottom.
It's yeah, sort of that's this... exactly what I thought. I thought, gosh, this is like being in Lake Michigan.
Where your feet can't touch the ground.
The that's only exactly. place where your feet can't touch the ground.
When you're in a body of water and there's a tide.
The ocean or a swimming pool or anything.
Never saw the ocean before
are...
I got here.
Got it.
And so, but so baseball though, so you clearly at eight were not at that. Have you ever gone to a World Series?
No, I've never gotten to go to a World Series game. And the Giants won three World Series about 10 and 15 years ago. But I didn't get to go to any of those games. The closest I ever got was I went to one A's playoff game in 1990.
Okay.
That was because my dad's best friend had season tickets. And he would get special good seats because he was in a wheelchair, and the Oakland Coliseum just had really, really bad disability accommodations. So there was only a few wheelchair seats and they were really good.
Yeah.
And then I went to a playoff game actually with a fellow podcasting pioneer, Jeff Ulrich, the founder of Earwolf.
Okay.
When he sold Earwolf and committed to a life of charity and being a rich guy.
Okay.
He's a big Cubs fan, and the Giants played the Cubs in the playoffs in 2016. And he sent me a text and he said, "Jesse, you're a big Giants fan, right?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Would you want to go to San Francisco and go to a playoff game with me?" And I was like, "Yes." And I like just bought a plane ticket right there.
That was very thoughtful. Holy smokes. I'm so glad that he, the Earwolf guy, went on to become a philanthropist.
Yes, he's a great guy.
He was a philanthropist directly to you.
Yeah.
And then also now
helping
poor
children attend the playoffs.
Exactly. and now helping a wider group of people.
But yeah, I've been a baseball, like basically starting when I was 7, 8 years old, when I was aware of sports.
Right.
Until now. There's been a little bit of ebbing and flowing in my teen years and early 20s when I went to arts high school and just didn't have a lot of friends that like sports.
Right.
And then I went to UC Santa Cruz and didn't have a ton of friends that like sports. But it's in the past, probably 10 years, it's sort of returned full force. But like as a child, it was truly my special interest. Like it was what I dedicated my brain to.
And did you play Little League? Did you play the game at all?
Yeah, I played until I was 15. In park leagues.
Okay.
I was never particularly good or particularly awful. I worked very hard to get to sixth best guy on my team.
But had a good time doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
What was I think I saw on your Instagram a quote that said, a lot of people want to play tennis and nobody gets paid to play tennis, but people still want to play tennis.
Steve Albini, the legendary rock and roll producer who passed away recently. I interviewed him 15, maybe years ago in Chicago and where he lived. And I asked him, this was like MP3 time. So I asked him like what the MP3 revolution meant for the music industry. And his answer basically was like, I think it'll be like tennis. A lot of people play tennis and they don't expect to get paid.
Right.
Yeah.
And which I think speaks to stand-up comedy. It speaks to podcasting. It speaks to almost everything except plumbing.
Yeah.
Right. Because you're definitely going to get paid for plumbing, but everything else, nobody's plumbing for free.
You know what they say, ask ass or cash. Nobody plumbs for free.
Right. And so, yeah. So I think that I'm glad that you played though. I'm glad that you enjoyed the game so much that you got to play.
Yeah. And I would play it right now if it was reasonable or adult baseball leagues were not composed exclusively of guys who played minor league baseball and college baseball and were such assholes that they couldn't give up constant competition.
Right.
I would be playing right now. My childhood best friend, the one that was at my house.
Yeah.
He was in a punk rock baseball league, adult baseball league in San Francisco with his fellow professional musicians.
Right.
And there's some appeal to that for me, but I'm also 42. I'm far too far beyond my,
but
what
if
skills
the,
I
if
had.
The game were something just to do for fun, you would definitely play.
I'd play on a slow pitch softball team in a second.
And
my life does not accommodate leaving the house for fun. unfortunately.
One day.
Yeah.
And 10 years from now. But
yeah, I'm going to play in a 75 and up slow pitch softball league.
That's it. So, and it'll be slow pitch at that time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So did you like Jimmy Pardo once described fantasy baseball, because that's what he did a Dork Forest about. He described it as fantasy accounting. And do you like the stats? Do you follow the statistics?
Jackie, how do you think I learned Microsoft Excel?
Oh, my gosh.
I'm going to tell you, it was as a 12-year-old doing the stats for the Rotisserie Baseball League, Fantasy Baseball League, that I ran myself with classmates in middle school. Yeah, and that was before you could download any of the data from the internet. So I had to buy Baseball Weekly and type it all in to Excel. I haven't played fantasy baseball since maybe my freshman or sophomore year of high school. And the reason is that I would just get too obsessed with it. Like, I would really just spend all my time playing fantasy baseball and none of it doing anything else.
Right. Because there are hundreds of games every year, right?
Yeah. So that's the thing about baseball. Like, the best part about baseball, like, people sometimes say to me, how can you like baseball? Because it's less exciting than football or basketball, and who cares about it and all that kind of thing, right? And like, the truth is, you like, yes, it is dramatically less exciting than than basketball or football.
Yes.
Like, I think I love both basketball and football. I don't I only really follow my teams some and only casually, but they're both great. And they are more exciting than baseball. But the great thing about baseball is it is a game that I used to have these cassette tapes of this public radio show called Selected Shorts, and they had an episode about baseball. So it was like 2 hours of readings of essays and short stories and stuff about baseball.
Okay.
It was hosted by Roger Angel, who's the greatest baseball writer ever and was also the fiction editor of The New Yorker.
Oh, wow.
And Bart Giamatti, who was president of Yale, but also became commissioner of baseball and was Paul Giamatti's father.
Okay.
There was a moment in that I remember very vividly where one of them said to the other, it always occurred to me that intellectuals like baseball because it goes slowly enough that they can understand it. And I think that what is special about baseball is not just that it gives you room for contemplation, but also that it is always there. It is like, it is a companion in a way that other sports are not. It also sort of reflects the passage of time in a way that other sports don't. It's kind of like a combination of a sport and something like fishing and also something like, you know, raising crops. Or gardening. Wait, I think
so,
fishing
so
or gardening.
It's literally the fact that it is a slow game, that it's that it's more contemplative than other games.
Yeah, and that you also, because the building blocks of baseball are very discrete, it is something that you can.
What are the building blocks?
That you can. Well, it's essentially a one-on-one confrontation, right? It is a pitcher, a hitter. Right.
Okay.
There are other players obviously surrounding them, but the essential element there is the pitcher and the hitter. Right.
Okay.
So that confrontation between the pitcher and the hitter is something that you can understand even as a narrative in and of itself, but also if you're interested in statistics, and I'm not a super, super, super statistics guy, but I'm interested. It allows you to understand and interpret the game much more coherently than you can with basketball or football, where there are just too many vectors to get a good external understanding, right?
Because it's more streamlined in baseball, maybe.
It's clearer. Like I said, it's more discreet. Like it's really ultimately about those two guys.
Yeah.
Once the ball is hit, it's about that guy who's going to get it.
Right.
And there have been advances in that understanding, but like there's a reason that the fundamental understanding of baseball has changed relatively little in what is now coming up on like 150 years, right? It is a simple thing that is that is very clear, but it's also much richer than, like, you know, track and like running, right? Like, yeah, running is as simple as it gets. It's what time did you get over this length of time, right?
It's you against the wind.
Yeah. Baseball is a much richer narrative than that. I mean, no offense to anybody that's really into track and field, but like
last episode of the Dark Forest.
It's a really great balance between those things, that it is like understandable, describable, interpretable, without excessive complication, but it also is a rich narrative structure, which I think is why baseball has by far the greatest literary tradition of American sports.
As far as like stories about it?
Yeah, stories about both fiction and nonfiction. Like, when I was a kid, Jackie, this is true. This is a literal truth. I have a bookshelf behind me on the Zoom that your listeners won't be able to see.
Oh, they'll watch it.
This is like a 6 foot tall by 3.5 or 4 foot wide bookshelf, the standard bookshelf size, you know?
Right.
When I was a kid, I had a bookshelf that big, full of books about baseball, and I had read them all.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
You didn't, are they in storage? Where are they?
I ultimately picked out my favorite, like 20. And sold the rest as a lot to a dad and his kid who were going to read them together.
Okay. Well, and so were they about the history of the game? Were they about specific players? Were they about everything?
Every
equipment?
every bit of it. I mean, like, Jackie, you say equipment. I have a friend whose blog I love to read that is just about baseball uniforms.
Oh my gosh. What is the name of that blog?
It's called UniWatch. His name's Paul Lucas.
UniWatch, Uniform Watch. His name is Paul Lucas. Okay.
Yeah, on my bookshelf right now, not the one behind me, which is just books that I'm working on for my NPR show Bullseye, but in my house, I have an entire book, like a hundreds of pages long book, you know, 10 by 12 or whatever, that is exclusively about baseball uniforms. But yeah, like the answer to your question is every piece of it, right? Like, I'm more of a humanities guy than a math guy.
Okay.
But, I also, you know, I'm good enough at the math to understand it. I'm not good enough to do the statistical analysis in and of itself, but I understand that which has been done by others. You know what I mean?
Right, and you can appreciate that work. Yeah. So you like the narrative of the people involved? Is that?
Yeah, but I mean, also, like, I think I have an outsider's understanding, and baseball is a great sport for having an outsider's. It's a fan sport.
Okay.
And it's not a fan sport just in the sense that, you know, like, football is a fan sport in the sense that it is a way it brings people together and they all root for winning and losing, right?
Right.
It's true of all team sports to some extent. But, like, I think baseball is a sport that really gives itself to the fan kind of dedicating themselves to understanding from an outside perspective. And because of exactly, like, the place I am age-wise, I'm an elder millennial.
Yes.
I came of age at a time when outsiders were revolutionizing the insiders' understanding of the sport of baseball. So,
okay, explain that. Yeah. Okay.
So there was a writer named Bill James.
Okay.
He lived in Kansas City, Missouri, and he started writing an annual sort of almanac of baseball called the Baseball Abstract.
Okay.
And he started self-publishing it and selling it in like classified ads in the back of the Sporting News around like 1980-ish. I can't remember exactly what year.
Okay.
The first year.
Not 1940-ish.
No, not 1940-ish.
Okay.
Right. And Bill James is a really wonderful writer with a real eye for, a great story. Like, what is fun about something? He's very funny, but especially just notices cool things.
Okay.
And And part of his dedication in this abstract was like, what questions could we answer about baseball through some kind of objective analysis? And he's more of a writer than he is a statistician. Like, I think the statistics side grew and grew as people who were better at math than he was continued to grow it. But it was questions like, you know what a stolen base is, right?
Right.
Jackie, like somebody's on first base, they run for second. They're allowed to run for second.
They're allowed to try. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the questions is, how valuable is it to try and steal second base?
That is an enormously philosophical question.
Right. So it's like, how many runs on average, what portion of runs, which is the points of baseball, is earned by getting that extra base? And what is the cost of the possibility you will be thrown out? So
I literally went, how valuable is it emotionally? Oh. You're talking about the actual game.
Right. I'm talking about in terms of winning, right? In terms of winning.
Yes.
And so that is a question that had not been asked or answered particularly. I mean, like maybe the sort of gut feeling is it's like, well, it's 50-50, right? You're either out or you're safe. So it's as long as you're getting there half the time, you're breaking even.
Right.
But the reality is that gaining that base is actually a lot less valuable than saving that out. So if you're not successfully stealing second base 2/3 to 3/4 of the time, you're actually, it's a net negative for you to be trying.
Now, was anyone angry because it's fun to watch someone try to do that? And now they've been given the math. Okay.
Yeah. So very much so. That's like been the sort of second. So understanding of things like that, or of things like, you know, one of the sort of legendary core baseball statistics was RBI, runs batted in, right?
Okay.
That's when you get a hit and someone else or yourself scores based on that hit.
Okay.
And you can understand
why
that's...
I've always wondered, so thank you very much. But I do, yes. Okay.
So you understand why that is an appealing number. It understands how many runs you generated, theoretically, right?
Right.
So Bill James was one of the first people who really coherently said, well, wait a minute. On the one hand, yes, you are counting a thing that happened that is important, right? So in that sense, yes. But does it measure how good you are? To some extent, but in large part, it's dependent on how many guys are on base when you come up to bat over the course of a season, right?
Oh, right.
And that was heretical to old-timey baseball people who were not math people.
Oh, right. Right. They were just like, no, the RBI, it's important. This matters. Yeah.
And one of the things that those early baseball analysts found was there really isn't such a thing as an RBI guy, right? There are guys who knock in, there are guys who are better at hitting and worse at hitting, obviously.
Right.
And there are guys who in the course of a given season knock in more guys than you would expect, which is to say bat better with runners on base than they do with no runners on base.
Oh, that's interesting.
But that is not at least identifiably a repeatable skill. It's just happenstance that they did better with runners on base that year than not.
Okay.
One presumes that at some level there is some skill involved in not being stressed out when there are guys on base. But whatever that skill is so insignificant as to be undetectable, right?
Okay, so it's not the cleanup spot, right? The fourth batter,
right?
So you would think you would put that person there,
right?
But it actually doesn't. Yeah,
yeah, and I think batting order is another thing that he looked at, right? There was this kind of classical idea of what the batting order is, which is essentially first batter is fast. Second batter has a lot of bat control because his job is to get the batter from first to second, or the leadoff batter from first to second. Third batter is your best hitter. Fourth batter is your most powerful hitter.
Wow.
Fifth batter is a powerful hitter that is less good than your fourth and third batter.
Just in case.
Yeah. And then essentially it's descending order of how good they are. And Bill James and his contemporaries were the first people to say, like, well, why would you bat your best hitter third when your first and second batter will end up batting a lot more than your third batter simply because of the order, right? You don't always go through the order the same number of times, right? So in a lot of games, the second batter has one more at bat than the third batter. Don't you want your best hitter to have that?
Yeah.
So they did analysis, and these days, with the teams having kind of caught up to this stuff,
right,
they realized, generally speaking, you want, A, it doesn't really matter if your first batter is fast. You want the guy that gets on base the most.
Okay.
And getting on base the most includes taking a walk in addition to getting a hit, which is something that previously people in baseball, before the 80s, people basically didn't think was a batter's skill. They thought it was a mistake by the pitcher rather than a skill from the batter.
When
in fact, batters have very different abilities to draw walks because a lot of guys swing at a lot of balls that aren't strikes, right?
Right.
And some never swing at balls.
Right.
And so it's like that.
You blow my mind, by the way, as far as like the big, because all I have are these big myths, right?
Right.
Like I've seen The Natural probably 6 times. And it's because what about the good eye? Is that real?
A good eye is real. That's kind of what that's kind of what we're talking about here, right?
Okay. Right.
And so that was sort of a sort of cataclysmic change within baseball. First from the outside in the 80s and early 90s, then from the inside, starting with the sort of events that led to the quote unquote Moneyball revolution, right? The Billy Beane and the A's, and that led to
No, I've never seen that movie, so I don't know what that is.
Yeah. So okay.
Is that the revolution that you were talking about? Okay.
So that revolution was essentially, Billy Beane was a former minor league player. He played a little tiny bit in the majors, who was very bright and had a great boss, a guy named Sandy Alderson, who built the Oakland A's of my youth. Sort of Jose Canseco, Ricky Henderson, Mark McGuire.
That was Oakland the team?
A's, Dave Stewart. Yeah, the sort of like late 1980s, early 1990s A's.
Okay.
Alderson, very bright guy. And he recognized that this guy, Billy Beane, was not a great baseball player. He's a great baseball player compared to us.
Right.
Not compared to other Major League Baseball players, but was very smart. And he offered him a job helping run the team, essentially.
Okay.
And Beane essentially recognized, very broadly, A's don't have a lot of resources. Oakland's a small town. And so they had to find value where other people were ignoring it. So they sort of learned to a variety of ways to kind of travel to the island of misfit toys and find what was good about guys rather than what was wrong with them. Right.
Right.
And became very successful having done that without having to spend a lot of money because they were looking for things that were players that were quote unquote undervalued. Right.
Right.
And he did that by essentially embracing these innovations that outsiders had, these nerds had in the 80s. Then everybody kind of caught up to that. Right.
Right.
So now all baseball teams, for a while, all baseball teams were run by guys with MBAs, with backgrounds in, statistical analysis.
Okay.
Now they're starting to be run by former Major League Baseball players with backgrounds in statistical analysis.
Oh, okay. Like
guys who are both of the things.
Right. Because they can, it's like being able to witness greatness and different values in different players. Cause they played the game for 30 years or whatever. Right.
But because of the fact that I grew up amidst that turmoil where we were smarter than the people running the team.
Right.
Was so thrilling to know that you were smarter than the people. I talk sometimes, there's this columnist named Grant Brisby, who is a columnist for The Athletic, which is the big sports news website owned by the New York Times.
Okay.
He writes about the Giants. And he and I didn't remember this, but he did. He and I were friends on Usenet,
pre-World
Wide Web.
Yes.
Message board internet. Mm-hmm. When I was like 15 or 17 and he was like 20. And he was said, I always thought I was like the little junior smarty pants of the Usenet group.
Sure.
Rec.sport.baseball.sfgiants. And actually, then I found out how old you were, and that made me really mad. But yeah, so funny. There's that, right? There's like the understanding how to put a team together, which definitely was an obsession of mine as a kid.
Okay.
Especially when because I knew by the time I was 9 that I was not going to become a Major League Baseball player. You know what I mean?
Okay. Like, yeah.
A Major League Baseball player is the best player. The best player in your entire city becomes a minor league baseball player. The best player in your region, in your age group, becomes a Major League Baseball player, right?
Did you ever see any of that coming up? Like in your life, have you ever met a kid or a young person that you were like,
no,
this person's amazing? Yeah.
I had a friend who played in the Cape Cod League, which is like a...
I saw them.
That's like a post-college wooden bat amateur league that a lot of players who play professional ball play in between college and...
It was the best baseball game I ever saw in my life.
That's a really
because
nice time,
because it was literally at a Little League field.
Mm-hmm.
And it was men.
Yeah.
Like it was adult men.
Gifted men.
Who were gifted and amazing at the sport.
Yeah.
And we were just standing just on the baseline watching them murder this ball and throw this so far.
A thing about baseball is also kind of an interesting combination of athletic sport and skill sport, right? Like if you take golf, right?
Okay.
Like golf is what would you say? Maybe 80% skill, 20% athleticism. Like athleticism matters. Like golfers have to be strong and flexible and
right.
They have to have strong proprioception. They have to be able to like know where their body is in space and repeat it and those kinds of things, right?
But sure.
But it's a skill. It's a skill thing mostly because you got a long stick with a whacking ball.
Right.
Thing
you
at
have
the
to
end,
have a good and, eye.
Yeah.
And then you have to have strength to back it up. Is
if
how
you
I
take,
think of golf. Yes.
Yeah. If you take basketball, I would say basketball is maybe 70-30 athleticism to skill, right? There's huge amounts of skill involved in basketball. But like if you're a really gifted 19-year-old or 20-year-old or 21-year-old, you can become a star basketball player.
Okay.
At the highest levels, you know, because you have such extraordinary, because your athletic gifts tend to peak, most of them, in your early 20s.
Right.
Whereas you build skill over time, right? Baseball is more, a little more balanced between the two, where even really, really gifted 19 and 20 and 21-year-olds very rarely are able to compete because they lack the skills. Those brain skills, they need years of repetition against the very, very best, which is why there's leagues like that Cape Cod League. But anyway, yeah, my friend Gray, my childhood, another one of my childhood buddies, his best buddy, he played high level amateur baseball. That's the closest I've ever been.
Oh, wow.
Because I didn't even, you know, these days, guys who become professional baseball players, they play, you know, travel ball and blah, blah, blah. I played in park leagues. Like, I lived in the hood. Like, we didn't even have our own bats.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
We had to borrow the other team's bats.
Oh, wow. That is that is, I think we even had a baseball bat when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But that is, I have this to say, because you gave me a list of things.
Yeah.
What is the development revolution? Is that what we're talking about?
Okay. So that's the next thing that happened.
Okay.
So my friend Ben Lindbergh, who hosts a great baseball podcast called Effectively Wild, wrote a great book called The MVP Machine, co-wrote a great book called The MVP Machine about this revolution in baseball. So essentially that first revolution was about recognizing who has skills that are not being valued, right?
Yeah.
The example in the movie, in the book Moneyball, is this player named Kevin Youkilis, who was not much of a fielder, not much of a power hitter, but took a lot of walks. And because people did not value the fact that he took a lot of walks, he was essentially free to the A's. And he turned out to be a reasonably valuable player, not like a star player, but like a useful player because he was good at this one thing that everyone else ignored. Right.
Right.
And that was that was the first revolution. It was like, what are the pieces of baseball that we didn't know were helpful to winning, or we undervalued how much they were helpful to winning? And how can we get guys who do those things for less resources than, like, everybody knows that Willie Mays, who was the fastest, strongest, everything, everyone knows he was the greatest, right? But who are the Kevin Euclises that you can get almost for free who are
and
still
useful? And
you
can make up a team of that.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah. And then you got a pretty good team. So that was step one. Step two is technology in the last, especially the last 10 years or so, has really transformed the way that baseball players go from where they are to what they could be. So rather than simply seeing baseball players mostly as static, like they have a certain amount of potential, and as they get older and stronger, they gain that potential on a relatively linear track based on maybe to some extent how hard they work, right?
Okay.
That's sort of a linear development path that you would imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Technology has allowed baseball players to have much more sophisticated training and practice that allows them to take exponential leaps in their performance.
What?
So an example of this is they have a high-speed, ultra-high-speed cameras. One of the brands is called Rapsodo. There's a few different brands, but a Rapsodo camera is essentially an ultra-high frame rate video camera, fundamentally. And using that camera and software, you can put that camera on a pitcher. Say you're a 22-year-old pitcher that just got out of college or whatever.
Yeah.
And that camera can track exactly how they use their body and exactly the way that their ball moves, right?
Okay.
In baseball, for a pitcher, you grip the ball different ways and use your hand different ways to make the ball do different things in the air.
Okay.
And 25 years ago, you'd have a pitching coach standing behind the catcher and he'd say, yeah, that was a good one. Or, that one didn't break much, right?
Mm-hmm.
With this high-speed camera, you can say that revolved at X revolutions per minute. That moved this distance horizontally, this distance vertically, right?
Right.
You know exactly on that one pitch exactly what you got.
Okay.
And so rather than throw, and you can only throw so many pitches as a pitcher. You know, if you're throwing a practice session, you can only do it 50 times before you're going to hurt yourself.
Okay.
So you have this limited window. And if you got that pitching coach, like, he can say that was a good slider, that one wasn't as good, you know. But if you have pitch to pitch exact feedback, you can have transformational changes from based on that feedback in what you're doing and what the result is. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How many pitches does a pitcher pitch in a game?
In a game, a starting pitcher will usually throw, the top end is about 100 pitches. But, you know, one of the things of this understanding, this sort of, that sort of second generation understanding of baseball is that, is the extent to which pitchers become less effective the more times a batter faces them during a game, right? So previously, the starting pitcher's job, in the 1958, the starting pitcher's job was to try and finish the game.
Ah.
These days, and then what they found was that in addition to getting tired, the familiarity that the batter has with the pitcher, the fact that they've seen their pitches.
Oh, okay.
Means that by the third time that a pitcher faces the same batter, they're dramatically less effective.
Wow.
And so, Yeah. So only the very best pitchers are able to make it through that third time around and remain effective. It's because they're able to vary what they throw, or they're just that good, or whatever.
Right. Right. They have to, whatever they're throwing is not adjustable, or they can adjust, they can make it different enough.
Right.
Is that correct? Okay.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, I remember when I was
a
kid.
You have made baseball fascinating, Jesse Thorne, by the way, which is not easy work for this one. And let me just tell you something. I just want Rangers. We're talking with Jesse Thorne, and Jesse Thorne has several podcasts. He's got the Bullseye. He's got the Jordan Jesse Go. He's got the John Hodgman one, all on MaximumFun.org. And I think Bullseye is also on NPR, correct?
Yeah, NPR stations around the country.
Around the country. And we're talking about baseball, you guys. And it's at Jesse Thorne, very famous, I believe.
On Instagram.
On Instagram. And just Jesse Thorne on Twitter, if you're still there. Anyway, yeah. So, okay. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted
Jackie,
to say.
Yeah. For example.
Yes.
In 1989, when I got into baseball as an eight-year-old, most people in baseball still believed that you shouldn't have big muscles because it would bind you up.
Okay. Like you couldn't run as fast or something.
Yeah, you couldn't. Yeah. Baseball is obviously not just about strength, right? You know, there's a lot of rotational stuff and agility and so on and so forth.
Oh, I see.
So
they thought, do something with your...
Yeah, if you got big muscles, you're just going to get slow and bound up and not be successful, right?
Okay.
Well, I mean, obviously, Mark McGwire took steroids, grew giant muscles, and was extraordinarily great because he had enormous muscles, right?
Who did he play for?
He played initially for the A's, later on with the Cardinals.
Okay.
But he...
You're not supposed to take steroids, though, right? And
no,
all
you're
of
not
these
supposed
sports.
To, you're okay. not supposed to play. You're not supposed to take steroids. They were not... the rules were pretty loose at the time.
Okay.
And so basic things like that were sort of... The training was based on wisdom passed down over 100 years, but that wisdom was not always based in an objective look at results. And so now that went from noticing that some guys with big muscles were being very successful to, you know, the new understanding of there's huge changes in the understanding of like how practice interacts with the brain and the body. Like, should you just be doing regular things at half speed or, you know, for example, my favorite team, the Giants, one of the big changes that they made when they hired a new manager and kind of had a new set of people running the show 5 or 7 years ago was, you know, batting practice is what you imagine happening. You know, when you get to the ballpark before the game starts, you see the guy behind an old coach behind a partial fence chucking balls at home plate while a guy knocks him over the fence and different guys wandering around, milling around, catching, shagging the balls and all that kind of thing. So that has almost no practice value. It does not improve how good you are. To some extent, doing something you are going to do later at half speed is a useful warm-up in terms of injury prevention.
Sure.
But it is not effective at teaching you to get better. So one of the things, for example, that the Giants started doing was instead of taking their batting practice on the field with the coach tossing them 65-mile-an-hour lobs, was they'd go into the batting cages in the bowels of the ballpark and they'd try and hit 120-mile-an-hour fastballs. Now, no human being can throw 120 miles an hour, thank goodness. But if you are trying to hit 120-mile fastballs, when you go out on the field and you get the 100-mile-an-hour fastball, a 97-mile-an-hour fastball, you are prepared to address it in a way that you're not when you are hitting 65-mile-an-hour
fastball. Right. What is there, because of this high-speed camera, I assume there's a clocked fastest ball?
Yeah. I mean, a weird thing about baseball fastball speeds is it depends where you measure the pitch. So if you imagine there's like the speed that is the average speed it travels between when it leaves the pitcher's hand and hits the catcher's glove.
Right.
Sometimes it is measured as the speed that it comes out of the pitcher's hand, the speed it's going as soon as those fingers stop touching it. And then there is sometimes it was measured by what speed it's going at the halfway distance between the pitcher's hand and home plate. Right.
Okay.
Each of these, the ball slows down as it travels. So each of these is different, right? And they have changed to some extent how they measure these things. So they're not always directly comparable with past numbers.
No, fair enough.
But the fastest are going to be guys like Jordan Hicks and Aroldis Chapman who throw in the 103-4 range.
Wow.
But the biggest difference is that these new training techniques have led – in just the space of 5 or 10 years, you know, the average major league fastball used to be something like 92, 93 miles an hour. So some guys are throwing 88 miles an hour. Some guys are throwing 97 miles an hour, that kind of thing.
Right.
To the average major league fastball now is pushing up around 95, I think, 94 and a half, 95, something like that.
Which means there's plenty of people that are throwing it
right,
closer
exactly.
to 100. Okay.
And a few different reasons. One reason is that training techniques have improved dramatically. We just kinesiologically.
Right.
We have a much better understanding of how to train the body to do a specific task better.
Okay.
That's step number one. So they do things like instead of just pitching at normal speed, they throw with weighted balls, which
okay.
I mentioned proprioception. Using a weighted ball makes you more aware of the way that your body is moving and how the pieces fit together.
Okay.
And they do a thing that basically one of the big things has been just teaching guys to throw as hard as they can.
Oh, like, wow.
They do things. They do what they call a pull down, which is they'll set up a net and they'll just have somebody run towards the net and throw it into the net as hard as they can. And you're basically teaching your body to just do it as hard as it can. And you can get an extra 10% from just not hesitating, just not holding back.
Is
subconsciously.
Is there injury though?
Yes.
I mean, like how...
How long do they last? So
yeah.
thing number one is these increased training, right? The pitchers are stronger. They know how to use their bodies better. They have these training techniques that give them feedback immediately. So they know if they change a little tiny something here or there, they get the feedback right away as to what was different rather than a guess from a guy who was trying to eyeball it, right?
Okay.
And so... that, you know, that feedback loop is closed. So they can, if they're trying to get a pitch to do a certain thing, they know exactly whether it's going in the right direction or the wrong direction.
Okay.
You know, closer or further towards that goal. The second thing is that teams have more pitchers on them now.
Okay.
And those pitchers are pitching less.
Okay.
For, you know, baseball games at the same length.
Right. The idea is not to finish the game anymore. So,
right. So
okay.
When I was a kid, it was, do you have 8, 9, or 10 pitchers on your team. Now, most major league teams have 13 and sometimes have 14, which is a lot more. I mean, that's 50%
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that it is much more common that a pitcher who is out there on the mound is just going all out the entire time they're there rather than trying to hold something back.
Right.
And you said, do people get hurt more? The answer is yes.
Okay.
The main reason being that there are a lot of parts of our bodies that we can strengthen through modern, you know, training techniques, right?
Right.
We all know how to get more flexible. We all know how to get stronger by listening to a personal trainer with a kinesiology degree, right?
Right.
But our ligaments are our ligaments.
Right.
You cannot right. strengthen your ligaments.
Right.
And so as-
It makes
as,
me want to rotate my shoulder, by the way.
Exactly. So like as players become more powerful physically, they are still doing unnatural movements, right? Pitching in particular. Other things as well, like
right.
you are starting to find some evidence that hitters are getting hurt a little bit more because they're swinging harder.
Okay.
Getting injuries to their obliques and stuff like that.
Okay.
Their backs and stuff, but it's especially pitchers because pitching is really just a fundamental danger.
Right. And and you can rip ligaments. I mean,
exactly.
I have a degree in political science and right. the word science is there, but it's not.
And pitchers do rip ligaments. And, you know, you've probably heard of Tommy John surgery.
No.
It's Tommy John surgery there was a baseball pitcher named Tommy John in the 70s and 80s. And he tore the ligament in his elbow, his pitching elbow, which previously had just been, that's the end of your career.
Right.
And a famous orthopedist named Dr. Frank Job, had the idea to essentially take the ligament out of his non-pitching arm and patch it across the-
God, that sounds painful.
Yeah. And it takes about, these days, usually about a year to recover from. You have to do
okay.
intensive rehab for about a year. But that ligament that you tear is actually not that essential to your day-to-day life.
Okay.
Which is why it's so weak, right? It's okay. like you don't necessarily need it to like take cans off the shelf.
Right.
But you do need it for pitching, right? And that used to be a very rare surgery. And these days, it's becoming more and more common for even high school kids or college kids to need that surgery, or for guys to get that surgery more than once. Or, you know, you've probably heard of Shohei Ohtani, the superstar baseball player for the Los Angeles. So he's maybe the greatest baseball player ever. He's playing right now for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He's both a superstar hitter and pitcher, which is the first time basically since Babe Ruth that has been the case.
Oh, cool.
In 100 years. Incredible.
I didn't know Babe Ruth was a pitcher.
See, yeah, he was a great pitcher. He was a great pitcher. For the first portion of his career, he quit pitching. Ohtani recently got the newest form of this, which is essentially a combination where you both put in a new ligament and put in essentially a superstructure around the ligament called an internal brace that protects the ligament. That is essentially a medical device. Like an artificial hip or something.
Right. You're making essentially a bionic arm out of this guy's. Are they still taking the ligament from the other arm? And what happens to that other arm?
The other arm, they do a different kind of repair on.
Okay.
That cannot withstand the rigors of being a professional baseball pitcher.
Sure.
But can withstand. Take... Yeah. So like, for example, once in a while, a guy who doesn't pitch will need to get this surgery.
Okay.
Shohei Ohtani is a great example. Shohei Ohtani is both a pitcher and a hitter, right?
Right.
And he got this surgery, I guess it would be a year ago or so now, 10 months ago, something like that. And he is still not pitching. But even having had this surgery, he is now able to hit. So he can't throw as hard as he can, but the other motions involved, even in being a professional baseball player, do not demand of that ligament what pitching does. And so you can return from Tommy John surgery as a position player, as a non-pitcher, in 6 months.
Wow.
8 months. Whereas as a pitcher, you're looking at 18 months.
Okay. And here's the next question. They have 13 pitchers. Do they also play other roles on the game, on the team?
Generally, no. Other than Ohtani, no.
Okay.
There have been a few players since Ohtani's sort of breakthrough, right?
Right.
The idea was always, it's just too hard to learn to play baseball. How could you possibly learn to hit and pitch at a level good enough to play in the major leagues, right?
Okay.
And particularly because, hitting requires just seeing thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pitching to build up your brain, to be able to understand as a ball is coming out of somebody's hand at 90 miles an hour, what direction it's going to go, right?
Right.
Just from recognizing with your eyes the way that the seams look on it from 60 feet away, you know, in that tiny split of a second, right? So you just need thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of reps. And that's very hard to do quickly. And so it's very rare for somebody's abilities in both departments to track together well enough that they can make it through the progressions from amateur to major league baseball while being good enough at both tracks consistently enough that they don't just like get ahead in one department and then the other department, they're just not good enough anymore.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like even somebody who might be able to develop enough skill to become a great pitcher and a great hitter or a good enough for the major leagues pitcher and hitter has a point when they're 22 years old where they're better at pitching than they are at hitting. And so they're not learning anything hitting because they're playing at the level of competition that their pitching dictates. Right.
How old is Ohtani?
Ohtani is I guess he's probably 30-ish now, 28, 29, something like that.
Okay.
But Ohtani was just a miracle. There have been a few guys since then who have tried to do it a little bit, but the main problem is it's so hard to develop both skills at the same time, in addition to getting to that level that's necessary, right? Most guys, you know, Major League Baseball has a draft, right? When you're an amateur, the teams pick the players so that they can't so that they can't have labor freedom.
But
when you're going to the pros, one team picks you, right?
Right.
Each of those drafts have rounds. Every team gets one pick, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first round, which is each team's one choice, right? Their one pick that year for who is going to be the absolute best amateur player for them to get onto their team.
Right.
Of those, about a third never even make it to the major leagues.
Oh.
Of the first pick, the first pick, look at every amateur baseball player in America. Each team chooses one guy, and only about two thirds of those guys even make it to the major leagues.
Wow.
It's hard. It's hard to do.
Right. It's a very, we're almost at an hour here, and I feel like there might be another 82 years you want to talk about.
I could talk about baseball for hours and hours. And should I just recommend some books? Can I recommend some books?
Please do. Please. Yes. Take this. Yes.
If you're already a baseball fan, these all will apply if you're already a baseball fan, but if you are already a baseball fan, a really, really, I think maybe the most fun you can have reading a book is called the Bill James Historical Baseball Abstract.
Okay.
So this guy, Bill James, who again was not the number one most insightful statistician, but happens to be a great storyteller, wonderful writer.
Okay.
He wrote this book that was sort of surveyed baseball history the way that he had surveyed each year's performance in his, you know, books that he advertised in the back of the Sporting News in a classified ad. He was working as a security guard, and I think he like stole a Ditto machine or something to print them up. Right.
I worked at Kinko's for almost a year, and there was a lot of bands making J boxes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Distributed a lot of your original screenplays during that time, I'm sure.
Sure.
But the Bill James Historical Baseball Abstract is really funny. If you want to know what the ugliest player from each decade of baseball's history is, you want to know who the Steve Jeltz or Don Mossy is, Google those names and find some really homely men.
Okay.
If you want to know who the greatest players are, or you just want to read great stories about players from
about individual players, that sounds amazing. Yeah.
Just a real joy of a book. And it's the kind of book, like I have a copy at my cabin and I can just sit down at the sofa, pick it up and read five pages anytime. No problem. Doesn't matter if I've read them before. It's hundreds of pages long. Like it's always there to give me joy.
Excellent.
I mentioned Roger Angel before. A-A-N-G-E-L-L. He passed away, I guess, about 2 years ago now, maybe, at the age of 101 or something like that.
Wow.
But he's the greatest baseball writer by a wide margin. He was fiction editor of The New Yorker, among other jobs at The New Yorker. He worked at The New Yorker his entire career. His stepfather, his mother was... a legendary New Yorker editor. His stepfather was E.B. White,
Charlotte's Web?
Yeah. Legendary essayist for the New Yorker and also author of Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little.
Okay.
And The Trumpet of the Swan, which is my favorite.
Okay. Good to know. Mm-hmm.
But Angel writes so beautifully that I think if you are a writing and reading nerd, if you just enjoy reading beautiful writing, it is impossible to top Roger Angel's writing about baseball. He was not a sports writer. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that worked at the New Yorker who they would let write a thing about baseball once or twice a year.
Cause they like the rest of his stuff. Yes. Yeah.
And he's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, universally regarded as the greatest baseball writer of all time, despite not actually being a sports journalist, because his writing about baseball is just, it's the best. It's breathtakingly beautiful.
You've given me two ideas for my brother Phil for his birthday, which is July 4th.
I have one last book recommendation here.
Okay.
This is a book called The Glory of Their Times. This is both a book and an audiobook. I recommend it infinitely in both forms. So in the 60s, this guy who was, I think he was an economist or something, but was an amateur historian, noticed that the ball players of the dead ball era, the time before Babe Ruth, were dying. And the ball players that were Ruth's contemporaries in the 20s and 30s were getting very old. And he said, I want to gather their stories.
Okay.
And in a lot of ways, he invented the oral history. You know, that is now every website article about anything ever for no reason. but his was one of the greatest, you know, he and Studs Terkel like sort of invented this form of like, of taking down people's stories as their stories, right?
Okay.
As an example of living history. And so it is all these ball players from the teens and 20s and 30s telling their stories in the mid 60s. And just, it is just a fucking kaleidoscope of amazing, hilarious. Like it was such a pirate ship, baseball in 1920.
Right.
Like just these stories about guys getting to the spring training by like hoboing.
Right.
Or, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
These crazy ball players like, Rube Marquard and these guys, all these wonderful, wonderful names, Chief Bender. And so it is, I think it might be the best single baseball book ever.
Are there stories about the Negro League?
So there aren't, although there is a great parallel book, to that book, that is called, I think it's called Only the Ball Was White, Stories from the Great Black Baseball Leagues. But yeah, the Glory of Their Times is just as great as it gets.
Right.
And, I also recommend that Negro Leagues one. That's also a really wonderful book. But one of the coolest things about the Glory of Their Times is these were audio recordings. This guy was going around recording.
And so if you, those interviews?
Yeah. So if you go, you can buy it on CD or it is on Audible.
Sure.
And I listened to it recently, I'd probably read the book two or three times over the years, but I had never listened to it. I listened to it a couple of years ago.
Is the book transcripts?
The book is essentially transcripts. It's edited transcripts, but it's essentially transcripts. And I was honestly shocked at to the extent to which it was transcripts. I was like, apparently these guys tell all their stories in paragraphs because there's very little editing apparent here.
Okay.
But I also figured it would be hard to listen to, like recording quality wise, but it actually sounds great.
Oh, good.
These archival recordings from 1965 that someone did with a portable recorder. But to hear these guys tell their stories in their own voices is just the most incredible thing. And I did a character on the Sklar Brothers podcast. They have a sports comedy podcast.
Right.
That was like an old timey baseball scout.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, to me, the greatest pleasure is just to make up dumb, weird, old-timey baseball stuff about like guys wandering through cornfields and and judging ball players by how big their dicks were,
right?
Or like how cute their girlfriends were,
mm-hmm.
or whether they had the good face, which is a big thing. All these different like stories about riding on trains and running scams and all these crazy upside down things about early 20th century America. So if you're a baseball fan, but if you're just a fan of wild stories or American history, that's a really wonderful book. The Glory of Their Times.
Well, Jesse, this has been kind of glorious as well. This has been amazing, you guys. Jesse Thorne, founder of the now worker owned MaximumFun.org. Has several podcasts on NPR and on MaximumFun.org and John Hodgman, the Jordan Jesse Go and Bullseye. It's at Jesse Thorne, very famous on Instagram. It'll be linked in the notes. Thank you so much for doing the show, Jesse.
Oh, it's a pleasure and an honor, Jackie. And congratulations on all your many years of podcasting. And as I said, Jackie and Laurie show, one of my favorite things ever. And I also like, I really think that one day you may, like me, be elected into the podcasting Hall of Fame.
The podcasting Hall of Fame. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
Hi, Adal. How was the show?
Well, you have to be nice because this is a dorkdom that is not your dorkdom.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I appreciate all dorkdoms.
That's right. We all appreciate all dorkdoms. It's baseball.
Oh, yeah.
And he made it fascinating. Jesse Thorne, founder of the Maximum Fun podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Daily Bob. Yeah.
Right.
The thing that I do with Lori Kilmartin.
Yeah.
And he has three podcasts, including one with Judge Hodge.
I hear his name on NPR. They talk about he does a thing on NPR that
a podcast there too called Bullseye. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's right. So Jesse Thorne talked about baseball, and he is a big San Francisco Giants fan. We didn't talk about them hardly at all.
Oh.
We talked about sort of the history of how the statistics, like...
Oh, right. Well, that's what made the game. That's
right,
what catapulted the game to fame, is the statistics, the stat block.
Well, except for how the statistics changed in the 80s.
Oh,
how everyone assumed certain things like RBI, runs batted in,
yep.
And how in the end, it doesn't matter. It matters to the scoring, but that's not that's not how you set up a team to bat. Like batting, it shouldn't affect batting order. It shouldn't affect anything. And how high-speed cameras have changed how people pitch.
Oh, I bet that's very true. I hadn't thought about that at all. But now we can actually watch people. You can watch the pitchers in high speed, slow-mo, frame by frame.
Right.
And see how they're doing it. Oh, that's tricksy.
Right. Real tricksy. And there was a guy named Bill James who started something in the 80s called the Baseball Abstract that he did by himself without he taught himself Excel. And just started making, and this was in the 80s, and it was an outsider view of how the game looked and from the outside. And then
as statistics.
And then,
okay.
It was taken by the inside and was taking inside baseball by the end of it. And then they started building the team using sort of his ideas, this guy, Bill James.
Oh, right. Yeah. He saw some patterns that nobody had seen yet.
Right, like the thing about RBI runs better than and asked weird questions like how valuable is it to steal a base? And Jesse Thorne said that, and I thought he meant emotionally, but he did not.
Right, he meant it in terms of how many does it actually get you more runs in the end than not stealing a base.
That's exactly what he meant. I thought. Right. And so.
Right. Game value.
Game value as opposed to. Right.
I understand these things.
But I will say he did recommend also there's a website blog called UniWatch by a guy named Paul Lucas.
Okay.
And that's what I want to go look at. And it's essentially it's an obsessive blog about the uniforms of baseball.
Well, you know, the uniforms for the LA Dodgers this year have been rife with controversy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Cause they're much thinner material. They were supposed to be like more breathable.
Yeah.
But they, have just been falling apart on them, like in the field, like they slide in and their pants come apart.
Oh, wait a minute. That sounds like a league of their own.
And then they get wet. And then this sounds like a league of their own too. They get wet and they're see-through. So they get a little sweaty, and then all of a sudden they're transparent.
Oh my God! I wish I had been able to ask Jesse Thorne about that. It's a classic Dork Forest moment where Andy. This is why we do these bonuses, is because you have other information than I do. All of a sudden, it's vaguely porny.
Right. Dodger porn.
Right. Well, he was talking about sort of the compelling narrative of the game, and he had several books that he also recommended that sounded kind of interesting. And of course, my brother Phil loves the game.
Oh, does he?
So this might be a good birthday gift for him for the 4th of July, which is when Phil Cation's birthday is, though he might have already read them. Yes.
All right.
Yes. Interesting. But it was a great episode. Super fun.
Sounds great.
I don't know anything about baseball, and now I know slightly more. It's kind of exciting. And you know the rules out there, Rangers. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?